Eric Wood, in one word, what do C-suite technologists and athletes have in common?
Progressive overload.
That's
two words.
But it makes sense, so we're good with that. I'm good with that. All great. All that and more on Transformers. What does transformation mean, and what can we learn from those leading the way? Join me as I talk to my fellow nerds about our experiences in technology, business, and just being human. I'm Anne Fanai, CIO and Vice President of Business Platform Transformation at IBM, and this is Transformers, a Think podcast. So Eric Wood, thank you for joining me today on Transformers. Why don't we start, just tell everyone a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Hey, yeah. I'm Eric. I'm the CTO at Cordance. Cordance is a private equity software company. We have a bunch of vertical B2B SaaS businesses that are very niche and very small, super interesting businesses that we work with every day. And I have the pleasure of managing a whole bunch of different technology across tens of businesses, hopefully, you know, more than that. As the years go by.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you on, it's like I'm feeling a recurring theme in these podcasts is folks that you grow up with professionally, folks in the small world nature of everything we do. So I think, good story to start is like, I think you and myself and Chris Anisek, who was a guest a couple podcasts ago, I mean, we all started around the same time. We all grew up together. We all cheered each other on. And I think, you know, you and I, in fact, professionally, let's see, you were IBM, left, got reacquired. Then you went to Under Armour. By that point, I had left IBM, went myself to work in private equity. Then you called me about a job at Under Armour, and I was your boss at Under Armour, which was,
Hey,
means we're good friends if we can work together like that.
That's right.
And then from there, I think we got, you know, we both dealt with MyFitnessPal being sold with Under Armour. I went out and did some other things. You went to another PE firm after MyFitnessPal. And the job you're in now, too, came through a mutual connection as well. So it's, I mean, we've had a really interesting professional arc together, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you've known me since I was an intern at IBM. And yep. I've known Chris since he was an intern at IBM.
And I was only a couple years ahead of you. So let's be honest. I think I was 25-year-old little child when you guys were interns. So trust me, my maturity wasn't there yet either professionally. But I think the other thing that's really interesting about as long as we've known each other, we also have a really interesting personal arc. Like we're both very athletic. I think both of us, our favorite thing athletically to do is lift heavy things. And I think one of the things I've noticed and I've had other folks notice that you sometimes professionally can tell when you're working with folks who have an athlete mindset. And I'd be curious your take on that.
I think one of the things that really helps, especially with what we do every day, is if you can go in to the gym or a hard place, right? Like if you're competing in something or you know, the stuff that we used to do at Atomic, like if you can come in and the thing you're facing down today is, how quickly can you do 100 sandbag get-ups with an 80-pound sandbag on you? And it, like, makes you, like,
okay, you're giving me PTSD bringing up sandbag get-ups.
I'm giving myself PTSD.
Yes, yeah, yes.
Like, thanks, Jake and Todd. And like, if you can do that and face that down, then, like, the fact that, like, you have a system that might not be working so well is a much easier prospect to deal with every day. And it infuses itself into everything, right? Like, hard conversations, you know, having to do anything that's kind of just a little scary, it really does help set your mindset toward being more successful in those scenarios, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think I love the way that you said not just like the professional decisions, but even the hard conversations you have to have at work. It's like, just, you know, you brought up the gym we went to together, a shout out to Atomic Athlete, because I'm sure someone will forward this video to them, given that we both worked out there. But I think, you know, I remember the sandbag get up challenge, like how many can you do in 10 minutes? And it's almost like if you can talk yourself into doing these really hard athletic things and convince yourself and you learn how to have the challenging conversation with yourself, and it makes it easier to have them out in a professional world.
Yeah, and it makes it easier for you to just kind of be vulnerable, like, and sit in that. And if you can sit in it there, you can sit in it anywhere. And so that helps a lot, I would say.
In terms of professional transformation, do you see any analogies to athletic transformation? Like, again, specifically something, again, back to what you and I love is how do we get that next PR on the deadlift, next PR on the bench or the squat? Like, do you see an analogy in what you do as a human to transform to meet your PRs and what we do in a corporate environment to transform?
In order to lift the heavy thing, you've got to measure it, and then you've got to train up to lift the next heavy thing and so on, right? The weightlifting world, that's, you know, progressive overload training. That's what we do. That's how that works. That's how we find our new PRs. In the corporate world, it's iterating. It's testing and iterating and choosing outcomes that are realistic, going and getting the outcome, and then choosing the next outcome that's realistic. I think a lot of times people go straight for this goal that's like, I'm going to cut millions of dollars out of my expenses. Like, you know, I'm going to cut $10 million out of my expenses. When in reality, if you could just cut $1 million 10 times, we've got our $10 million. But people get hyper-focused on that endpoint, and they go try to find the big thing, but we can build and build and iterate and get to that cut a lot faster if we kind of focus on the thing that's in front of our face and get to the first goal and then get to the next goal.
No, I think you hit on something really important there too, is it's really easy to look at where the big dollars are, where the big things are, and say that there's got to be something in there. And I remember our time together at Under Armour, we would be constantly justifying, like, can you tell me what every engineer is spending every minute of their day on? And at some point it's like, okay, I recognize it's a big dollar, but yes, we can. You know, we've got the JIRA tickets, we've done, you know, we have all the project management documentation, but maybe the problem isn't there. Perhaps the problem is we're not doing our user research correctly. We're not picking the right features and functions that we want to go out to our customers with. And the idea of looking at the small turns of the crank versus, like, the, you know, move the whole wheel versus just like kind of those little minutiae help.
It's also scary, right? Like, you're told to go out and find some giant number, that's scary. And a lot of people, myself included, get stuck with blank page syndrome. Well, how do I do that? How do I get to that? Instead of that, it's, well, all right, let's go get this little thing first and start to build the muscle of, and we actually say that all the time around here, but start to build the muscle of acting that way. And so, you know, if we can act in a certain way that allows us to be more, I'm using cost as an example, but it's cost, it's build a product. I mean, we're putting together, we're revamping our entire quote to cash process right now. And that's huge. Like, it affects everything. And it's a technology-driven solution, but there are a lot of, like, there's a lot of muscle memory in that of hey, this person doesn't talk to that person anymore. This person talks to that computer.
And that is the root of it so much, is like, you realize people aren't talking to each other, whether intentionally or not. Sometimes it is like, I just don't want to pick up the phone and talk to that person because I have my thing. And I mean, that becomes a big hindrance in transforming. Whereas, like, maybe keep drawing on the athletics analogies, like, if we didn't listen to the feedback from our coaches to say, hey, you're not getting the depth of the squat, you know, adjust where your foot position is. I notice on your deadlift, like, you're starting to lose your back shape as you go down on the deadlift. Like, if you didn't have the coaches telling you that stuff, you know, you're going to fail athletically lifting heavy things in the same way that, you know, you don't, the disconnects between people, process, technology can drive the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the other thing, obviously, we've kind of got some shared experiences being at larger companies and private equity owned companies as well. I'm sitting in the large one right now. You're sitting in a PE company right now. I would be like, one of the things that I find fascinating about it, especially coming back to IBM, is that, you know, with IBM being a, you know, $60+ billion company, you lose sight of kind of the optimization and the fastest path. And something I often tell my team is, at a larger company, you might want to build a Rube Goldberg machine when you just need a slide, right? And just get from point A to point B. And how have your experiences kind of compared and contrasted as well, PE versus other larger companies?
There's definitely a bias toward action where it's like, I don't have time to build the Rube Goldberg machine. You're getting a slide, whether you like it or not. And if the slide doesn't work, maybe we'll add something to the end. But for the moment, you know, that's the way we go. There's also it's a much more constrained environment, right? Like we're not like traditional private equity in the sense of like, we're so hyper-focused on cost at all cost. That's not the goal. We try to help grow our businesses and Cordants in particular, the goal is not to spin them off like a traditional private equity. So to that end, we do keep a growth mindset and we look at the balance sheets that way, but we're still very, very particular on where we spend our money and why and how, and doing as much as you can with as little as you can. You know, our headquarters, the operating bit that runs all those smaller SaaS companies I was talking about, we're not very many people. My team as a CTO, I think this is the smallest team I've ever had. I think I have 8. We do a lot for 8 people. And, you know, everything we look at is, how do you gain scale? How do you gain leverage? How can I do more with one human? How do I maximize their time and their attention and not burn them out, right? Like we obviously never want to do that, but it is a big focus. Like I can't just go hire somebody. It's use technology to solve problems in all sorts of different ways. So it's a different set of constraints for sure.
There's kind of sometimes like maybe a process or something existed before because the technology couldn't solve the problem. And at a large company, I can't just say, well, the technology's here now. You're re-engineering a process, like you're re-engineering part of the sales cycle or part of the finance cycle. And you got to say, okay, I know there were humans needed, some human glue needed there. We don't need it. And it's this risk when you're not coming from a place of scarcity, put it that way, or not with that scarcity mentality of saying, it's okay, we'll just kind of tuck that under the bed. And, you know, like kind of when you're a teenager, you shove all your crap under a bed and your room's clean. You just can't do that at all. There's nothing that can be hidden with the controls and the environments in private equity.
No, and everything's looked at repeatedly and constantly. And so it's we're very mindful, especially when it comes to people. It's if I'm going to hire somebody, that person is a permanent fixture on the staff. It's not like, oh, for the next couple of years, like maybe this person's fine and then maybe we can do something else. No, no, no. Like that role needs to exist for almost perpetuity, if you will, because we really want to avoid, having to cut people. Like that's not fun or fair to anybody. And so you make very mindful decisions. And you try everything you can before you pull that trigger. That's the last lever, is adding people.
Well, and I'd love your perspective on how process is perceived in your experiences too, because I think sometimes in private, I'll actually say sometimes the extremes happen. Like there's a love of process sometimes because it's a control. It's a, you know, like it's an audit control point or something to that effect versus, in process might be viewed as good, but then sometimes in private equity, process is viewed as bad, but you actually need that process. Like I know we talked at MyFitnessPal when we were spun out about there, we did need some processing controls around data, for example. Like we had, what was it, 250 million lifetime users of data that we had to protect their data. So, you know, the inclination may not have been a controller process, but you know, we had to build the case like you do need it if we want data security and privacy.
It is interesting because the more you have, you know, the more process you put in place, the more there's a perception of bureaucracy. To some extent, what we've found is process is the thing that helps you scale. I think it's the act of writing it down more so than the act of actually doing the process. Because that's by writing it down and putting it in a place, now everybody kind of stares at it and says, oh, well, you can take that step out. The goal is to minimize the number of hops. It's not to maximize the use of the people and use more people. It's to minimize the amount of time it takes to get through something. So if you're doing something repeatedly, we're going to put a process in place for it. But we try not to put too many of those in place because that now means you need more people to oversee them. And again, you know, we're trying to keep them super lean. So it's the more people I have to oversee processes, the more people I have to hire. Like, so it's a reliance on technology instead of what kinds of stuff can I put in place to do this for us? How can I leverage technology to do stuff for us and not rely on, you know, having 18 approvals for one thing kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's kind of that fine line between your min set and creating a situation where people find purpose in the process versus a purpose in the outcome, right? So, well, let me do a pivot, because I think you know, one of the things you and I, you know, chatted about getting ready for this is AI. Like, AI is everywhere, right? And this comes up. It's going to probably come up in every podcast. But I think, again, what's really interesting is the next layer down in AI. Like, what's driving it? What are factors? And do you have a perspective on how AI is being approached in the private equity space? Again, you, with Cordance being the company, is you have the opportunity to see lots and lots and lots of companies. But is there a different perspective on approaches with AI that you're seeing there versus what maybe the headlines are showing about AI?
So certainly, you know, I think the headlines have a lot of like inflated, you know, this is going to become general intelligence. It's getting rid of jobs, blah, blah, blah. I don't see that's not happening for us. What is happening is it's being used of and thought of in two different ways that we really see and actually support. One of them is a leverage point, right? Like cognitive offloading into things like we use Coda as our documentation repository here at Cordance, and they have a big AI presence that they're running through where you can, you know, basically ask questions of the body of work that's in there. Great. That's cool. We have analytics tools that are doing the same thing. They're using AI, and I can go into Slack and I can ask a question of my data of, you know, how was revenue last quarter or whatever, right? And it'll go and make a little chart for me and put it in Slack. Those leverage points are super interesting because that is the thing that will allow my data team to scale, for example. So instead of that, instead of somebody barraging somebody with a bunch of questions, can we get the AI to help as that first line of defense, if you will, before the higher order questions come in where you actually have to put some, you need, you know, human context, right? That's one set of things. And it's not like a push. It's just like a, what can we do there kind of thing.
Would it be a correct characterization? Like, this is back to kind of maybe a little tied to the process, is like AI to stream your AI to stream, like streamline how you operate and run the company. Not to lead the witness, so to speak, but I think you're maybe the next spot is like, how are the companies themselves using it as part of their products?
Yeah, 100%. And then we are seeing a lot of that. And we're seeing that also manifest itself in a couple different ways. One of them is we have, you know, brought on a few businesses where they use AI. It's built into their products. A lot of it is pretty much what GPT does best, which is like writing emails, you know, using context to write a better email kind of stuff. But there are some pretty interesting places where we're starting to look at, well, can AI take over certain chunks of functionality that were kind of harder to deal with in the past. There's also, once they come on board, they come to us and say, well, all of our competitors have AI. And so we get to go through the questions of, well, is that actually AI? Or is that just them putting AI on their website and doing something AI adjacent or fancy, right? And half the time it is that, half the time it is actually AI. And so the other thing is, can we give folks guidance on how do we do that? And so one of the things that I spent a lot of time on last year was providing that guidance back to the businesses to basically say, all right, well, we're not going to be able to do like one thing that just anoints every product with AI. By, you know, if you just do this one thing, that's not a thing. But we do have a couple things that we were looking at, and some of it is just simply, can we help you with the infrastructure needs of AI? You know, can we take advantage of programs that some of our vendors provide that allow you to accelerate your way into AI? Another one is, well, we have a pretty massive data warehouse. Can we pull more of your data in and use that capability that has some AI in it? And so looking at it from a bunch of different angles on how to enable those businesses with AI has been a really interesting challenge. Some of them, yeah, it's just like kind of a toy, like you have to do it because everybody else is. But there is
got to say they're an AI company, and yes.
And so, but there's also some really interesting and super legit places where it comes in. It could be a game changer for them.
Something came to my mind as you were going through that is, you know, if I think about different stages of company life cycles, right? So like usually early seed stage, like venture capital backed, they see a niche that they're filling in the market, right? Then you start moving to private equity, you're a little bit more established. You know, you've got a set of customers versus maybe one or two customers you're targeting. Do you see with the companies, like the companies you've worked at in this private equity space, is it customer requirements that you see driving it, or is it something like you're having to show the customers how AI might help in the product? And I know I'm throwing you a curveball with that one a little bit.
It's not so much driven by customers. You know, having such niche products that we do, those customers are not asking for AI so much as they're asking for solutions, bespoke solutions to their problems. So a good example is we have three different CRMs that we operate. And those three CRMs are all very focused on industrial distribution use cases. Salesforce sells into those same places, but they often choose our products because they were made for that market. And so Salesforce can come in and say, okay, well, we've got Einstein and all these AI things, and those are great and pretty compelling. But we can come in and say, well, but we also like you work with your specific ERPs, and there's a little bit of AI, but it's really in the how do you manage contacts? How do you, you know, so we can add leverage to your sales teams to help them better manage contacts, right? The customers aren't necessarily asking for AI. They're asking for, how do you help me scale my business? How do you help my business be more successful? Every once in a while, you'll get somebody that's like waves their hands and says they want AI. But it's really in these smaller niche spaces, it's really about the fact that there's a bespoke solution in place and that bespoke solution will help their business be more successful.
Again, it's interesting where the push and the pulls come from, I think, as you dig into like, I mean, not just CRMs, but large like ERP types of systems, right? At some point you're generalizing and saying like AI is going to kind of speed the chain, if you will, versus like if you can really hone in, which it sounds like the companies you're working with are doing, is like, you know, any infusion of AI is just, it's driving a particular and specific solution.
Exactly, yeah.
Eric, in talking about these, really just the optimization that comes with the tightly controlled private equity environments, what I hear you saying is, you know, there's no space for customization, whether it comes to the tools you're using or AI on top of that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because we look at it in two different ways. Like the technology that I provide that works across the entire business, that does need some space for customization. But the things that we sell, they are already very hyper tailored to the environments that they're in. So it's not like, hey, I built this product and I snapped in some generic solution. It's, I built this product and I snapped in, you know, this AI thing that does this particular process for you. And I know how that process works because I was in the industry myself. Like those are the kinds of things that we're providing out to the market.
Now, and I think it's interesting as a kind of a consumer of this products in the CIO seat over here is, you know, again, my observation, I think back to when we were setting up MyFitnessPal, we're like, throw this out of the box, throw this out of the box, throw this out of the box. Whereas, you know, coming to IBM, what I think is interesting is we've bought these large solutions that you need to run a $60+ billion enterprise, but then, you know, there's a tendency to want to implement the solution and customize for a corner case versus saying, you know, hey, maybe we should rethink our process And the tools got it right. They've done the user research. They've figured out the user experience. And so I've actually found myself, I'll say almost uncustomizing and looking at what the AI layer on top of an uncustomized solution would be. Like we have, I spoke with the CIO of Salesforce on this podcast, and we did one Ask Procurement. That's going to be one of the agents for Agentforce that we co-developed with them. And, you know, it's, don't go into the large, we use Ariba, right? Don't go into Ariba, but you can use that layer above that's an Ask Procurement. And so I think that's, you know, the interesting, like the conundrum of out of the box versus customization. And especially in your case, when you're talking about a very, very specialized solution, would you want to customize it anymore anyway?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, we have 20 something businesses now. And when we look at solutions for ourselves, the option is, well, do I allow all 20 of those things to just do their own thing? Or do I say, no, you don't get to do that. We are going to just kind of go with this thing. This is how it works out of the box. It's funny because at least once or twice a month, I have to tell somebody like, no, we're not customizing this. We're going to use the thing that's out of the box, and it'll be fine. Let's try it that way first. If it falls flat in its face, we'll do something else. But this exists. It's implemented. I don't have to, we don't have to spend a lot of time with it. Like, let's move and then see what happens.
I'm going to do a little bit of a pivot now. So one of the things that is a core tenet that I wanted this podcast is bringing the human side. Those of us that sit in these seats, we all have experiences that have shaped us, whether it's, professional or personal, things that have shaped us. And, you agreed to share a little piece of your story that I think, shaped who you are today personally and professionally. And thank you for being willing to share this. I'll turn it over to you and let you say your story. I think others might like to hear.
Sure. Yeah. I don't think I've ever done this on camera. It's weird.
Again, thank you.
So one of the opportunities that I think was really interesting for me was at Under Armour, where I got to be one of the founding people of the Under Armour LGBTQ group of folks. And so, coming out at work is a thing for us. And it's interesting over the years, right? Like I've had a pretty long career, and you spend a lot of time hiding things before you're actually out. And that oftentimes comes back to haunt you in certain ways, like, weird aside, but it proves the point is when I was in high school, my yearbook teacher was in the closet, and he would freak out on a regular basis and then like yell at people if they did something wrong and then like go off and have to have a walk. And, in high school, I knew I was gay, but I wasn't out, and I made it through college and still was kind of hiding everything. And my first few years at IBM, I wasn't out, and it manifested itself in weird ways that just made everything more stressful. And over the years, I eventually just kind of came to terms with, well, you kind of have to just be able to be fully yourself wherever you are. And if you're in a place where that's not possible, then that's probably not the right place for you. For me, it was IBM was always a super welcoming place, and you and I have friends that were in that group of Eagle. And
one of the stories I remember is we both had a wonderful leader, Jane Harper, we work with, and another guy, Steve Dale, on the team. And one of the things I remember Steve sharing is they called it the water cooler conversation. And it ties, I think, to your high school teacher's story too, I would imagine. It's, as someone who is dating a, opposite sex, cisgender relationship, the societal view for many, many years, you come in like, hey, Anne, what'd you and your boyfriend do? What'd you and your husband do? What'd you and your kids do? And if I come in and say, hey, Eric, what did you and your wife do? It's not the same conversation, right? And it's unnecessarily, unexpectedly, or I shouldn't even say unnecessarily or unexpectedly, it's like unintentionally maybe creating an awkward situation. And, it was just a graphic that I remember Steve showing, and it has really stuck with me for many, many years about this idea like that you hit on, is like being able to bring your entire and whole self to work.
There's a meme I'll send you after this. but the water cooler conversations are a thing, right? Like we did this and that and my weekends are very different. And so, what that involves is neither here nor there, but it's especially being in this seat, it's really interesting because it does change how, I mean, it has changed being a people leader, for a while now, right? It has really changed how I operate and how I work with others and how I, use a lot of empathy. Going back to our fitness analogy, there's a SoulCycle instructor that we both used to go to in Austin that I saw yesterday.
And I know, I'm so jealous you got to see Nikki and go to her class. Yeah.
And she closes all of her classes with like, be nice to the other kids on the playground because you never know what they're going through. And that's 100% true in this case. And I have had, being in the position that I am, I've had people come out to me at work. I've had people just pull me aside and say thank you for giving them the space to be able to be who they are and not have to hide. Not to take an even remotely political bend, but with a lot of legislation that's running counter to that right now, any environment that can provide a more welcoming space, or even, you don't even have to acknowledge it. Doesn't matter. Like it just doesn't matter. But if you can allow folks to be themselves and come fully to work, you will get the best thing that they have to offer you too. You're going to get all of their attention and time. You're going to get all of the quality. You're going to get all of the benefits of that.
I often think of it like, as a female in tech, I'm generally in a minority, as well. And I've always often thought of it as being, I'm very privileged to be in the situation I'm in. It's worked my butt off. I know you've worked your butt off. We're really privileged. And sometimes as people are growing in their careers, they don't feel like they have those open spaces. And, I think another thing, you and I have a very, my best friend, a very dear friend of yours passed from cancer this past summer. And, I shared that story a little bit in my spaces and, it's actually been similar. Like folks, like I'm struggling with this and I thought I had to, bifurcate this and like, I can still do my job, but I might have moments and there's some struggles, and I think it's really, really great. So, but thank you for sharing your story, Eric. I mean, like, I know I'm very appreciative that you were willing to share it, but I think again, this human side is, where you ended it is so accurate. If you can allow and create environments for people to bring their whole selves to work, that is how people give the most of themselves. This is how you get the best out of folks in their job. So they know they can, they know there's no fear in what they're doing every day, or they don't have to be small in what they do every day.
Yeah, exactly.
Eric, thank you so much for joining me today. Loved all the conversations and, again, just can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day on this one.
No, thank you for having me. It was awesome.
Thanks everyone for joining us. Hope you enjoyed the conversation, and we hope to see you back next time.